Time to go ahead and do this. How we doing, church? How we doing, guests? How we doing, people? All right, I'm doing really, really well, and I'm going to tell you why. All right, I'm going to tell you why. And you're going to judge me for this, but I don't care. We have any baseball fans in the house? What about college baseball fans? What about Coastal Carolina University fans? All right, that's surprising. Well, being that I am a baseball alumni of Coastal Carolina University, I am just proud to announce that they are national champs. All right. Yeah, I'm not going to make anybody clap, but feel free to get those palms going. And I had the privilege of attending the first two games in that three-game series out in Omaha. Had the time of my life, and I'm still working through complications from yelling like a two-year-old. Those games, so bear with me if I lose my voice. It's a direct result of the College World Series. Forgive me for that. At any rate, we're going to stop talking baseball at this point in time. We're going to dive headfirst into week 14 of our series through the book of Colossians that's entitled Following Jesus. And in essence, I think at every bend, as we've worked ourselves deeper into this book, what we're finding is that following Jesus, what that effectively means is it means bringing the gospel to bear on absolutely every area of your life. We've seen Paul apply it to all types of relationships, and for the past couple of weeks, those relationships were in the context of marriage, in the context of parenting, and now we're going to talk about relationships in the context of the workplace. And as I said, you know, following Jesus, what that means is you're not allowed to be this weekend warrior Christian where, you show up on Sunday, you clap, and you're like, yeah, good word, and then you move on. What following Jesus means is that the gospel has a bearing and it has implications in your personal life and in your private life and in your public life. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about our public lives today, and that's our lives in the workplace. And so I'll be working from Colossians chapter 3, verses 22, and we'll work right up to chapter 4, verse 1. And for those of you who've been tracking along, we've been in this thing this is week 14. We still have a few weeks left in this series. And what that means for us as a church is when we preach that final sermon, we will have effectively walked through absolutely every verse in the book of Colossians. I think that's a pretty big deal, and I'm really proud to be a part of the teaching team that's been a part of this sermon series. So let's go ahead and get to work. I'm in chapter 3, verse 22, where we read, "Slaves, obey your human masters in everything. Don't work only while being watched in order to please men, but work wholeheartedly, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, do it enthusiastically as something done for the Lord and not for men, knowing that you will receive the reward of an inheritance from the Lord. You serve the Lord Christ, for the wrongdoer will be paid back for whatever wrong he has done, and there is no favoritism. Masters, supply your slaves with what is right and fair, since you know that you too have a master in heaven." So here we are, right in chapter 3, the tail end of chapter 3, and Paul gives it to us heavy. He uses a buzzword. I believe this is a buzzword, and the word I'm referring to is the word slaves. He says, "Slaves, obey your human masters." And if you're anything like me, your mind immediately went to your working definition of slavery. My working definition of slavery, having been reared in the United States of America, is what I ran into in history books, or in my social studies class, or whatever it was for me that put me face to face with American history. And so my frame of reference for slavery is a form of slavery that is marked by specific behaviors, specific motivations, and specific things. And I think the danger there is I don't want to overapply what I know about slavery in the United States of America to what Paul is referring to, because Paul is dealing with a context in the we could call it Rome, generically speaking. This is more than 2,000 years prior to the even existence or the thought of a United States of America. So Paul in no wise is talking about the North American slave trade, nor is he referencing American slavery when he says slaves, obey your earthly masters and everything. And so I think it's really important that we establish some ground rules, a framework for for understanding what Paul is talking about, and so we need to make some distinctions. So if I were to preach a sermon on American slavery, my first and probably my only statement on the matter would be it was an atrocity. It was a slavery motivated by racism, and it was just downright wrong. It put a group of people in a superior position at the expense of people who were thought of as inferior. It dehumanized an entire race of people. And basically what that meant is people, human beings created in the likeness and image of God, were added to the economic portfolio of white folks. That's a difficult pill to swallow. But that's the reality. That's American slavery. American slavery disregarded completely the human dignity that God has placed into every man, woman, and child who's been created in his likeness and image. American slavery is an atrocity, and it's wrong. Paul's not addressing American slavery, and he's not even talking about that. That's not his frame of reference. What he's referring to is what we could call ancient forms of slavery, or we could call it Roman slavery, and that is markedly different from the definition that we have with regards to our experience. And so if I look at American slavery and I contrast it or juxtapose it with Roman slavery, American slavery is a life sentence. You don't get out. You are bought and sold. You're traded and you don't get out. Families are destroyed. Mothers are ripped from the presence of their children. Husbands and wives separated. Sibling groups separated. And so what that meant was this is a life sentence. And not only is it a life sentence, it's a multi-generational sentence. Because what you get is a family that in essence doesn't really have a heritage. There's no family tree to point back to because no one's ever drawn one. Generations are separated from generations and the repercussions continue. It's not something that was just seasonal. It's something that had impact far beyond a singular generation or a singular number of years. Roman slavery, however, was markedly different. Generally speaking, if you were a slave in this place called Rome, by the time you were age 30, you were no longer a slave. You were granted freedom and you were able to go about your business. Nobody was telling you what to do anymore. In addition to that, you were never dehumanized as a Roman slave. And in fact, as a Roman slave, your social status was completely tied to the social status of the family for whom you worked. So this could be a step up for people. This could be a step up from like a socioeconomic strata that otherwise you never would have gotten out. So becoming a slave could have been a benefit to you. And we'll talk a little bit more about what I mean there. So it's not a lifetime sentence. It affords you social status, whereas in America, you were stripped of any social status as a slave. You had zero social status, zero standing in society, zero range of motion. You couldn't get a job. You couldn't go to school. Whereas in Rome, you actually had a better job in some cases. You were able to, you had access to other economic and educational opportunities that otherwise you wouldn't have been afforded. And so in the United States of America, black people in particular were bought and sold. That's how they became slaves. Now, in Rome, however, it was markedly different. There were a variety of ways through which a person could become a slave. One of those ways I think most of us are very familiar with, and it's this thing called debt. Why are we quiet? I mean, it's something that we're navigating, right? If we're honest, people have debt. If you're a person, the potential is that you have debt. Maybe you don't. If you don't, give somebody next to you a hug, encourage them, like counsel them, coach them, tell them what you did to get yourself out of the hole of debt. But debt could have landed you in the prongs of slavery in the ancient world. Because what that meant as a lender is the people that were borrowing money from you, effectively, they became a person that you had at your disposal. You had access to their time, to their talents, to their efforts, because they owed you something. And it's kind of like this. You take out, you fill out that credit card application that you're really not supposed to be filling out to begin with, depending on who you are. And you don't read the fine print. But had you read the fine print in Rome, what you would have read is, by the way, when you can't deliver on this debt, we're going to own you until you can deliver on this debt. I think if we're honest, I think if that were the fine print, we were left reading, I think we'd second guess how easily we jump into this pool, this deep pool of credit and credit card debt and everything that comes with it. So in Rome, you could become enslaved as a result of your debt. I think that's the same case we have here, only, you know, you can do it from your home office or you can do it from your home. Nobody even has to know about it. Nobody's going to tell you what to do, but ultimately, you're working paycheck to paycheck and you're trying to make ends meet and you've bitten off more than you can chew. And so in essence, you, in a way, are enslaved to your debt the same way that slaves in Rome were enslaved to theirs. Now, another condition or another circumstance or scenario that could have landed you in a scenario in which you have a master and you're considered a slave would have been you decided that. Like, that's what you wanted to do with your life. Maybe you hit a rough patch, you're unemployed, job security is gone, the job market is bleak. Maybe the family business that you were trying to pick up from its proverbial bootstraps and make productive, maybe that never worked out, maybe it hadn't worked out. And so of your own volition, you approach someone in your midst who's affluent, who has access to resources that you don't have access to, and you simply say, hey, let's negotiate something. I want to work for you. I want to be a part of your extended family. I want you to have access to my gifts, my talents. And in exchange, you're going to give me a place to stay. You're going to give me access to social status that I've never experienced. And so there's an exchange going on. This is markedly different than what happened in America. There's a bit of give and take. It's a negotiation. You're not sold into that against your free will. You're saying, hey, this is going to give me job security. This is going to give me something that I can't attain on my own. And so I think those two forms of slavery that we've just talked about, in being in debt and embarking on this journey as a servant or a slave in someone's household, those are what I would describe as they're relatively just ways of becoming a slave. You know, you're not being sold against your free will. You're actually, like, one of them is a result of your poor decision making, and the other one is a result of you're making a decision that hopefully is going to give you a step ahead. Now, there were some unjust ways that a person would have become a slave in the Roman Empire, and these are very similar to what happened in the United States of America when we talk about slavery. One of those was, as a result of war, a conquering nation simply would have enslaved all the people that they conquered. So in effect, you know, a war takes place, somebody wins, somebody loses. You lose, you become a slave. In addition to that, there was a thing going on that has been labeled as infanticide. Basically, you had people who the authority they were allotted as parents basically said, you have ultimately the authority to kill your kids if you want to. And that happened a lot of times because people have preconceived notions about what they value. And so there were families that maybe they were waiting on that son, the heir of the family that was going to take the reins of the family and continue the legacy of the family. And unfortunately, they were given a daughter. And so they made a decision. We don't want this daughter. They discard the daughter. They throw the baby out with the bathwater, in a sense. Babies were left to fend for themselves, and many times they died because no one came to their rescue. However, there were cases when an individual would find a child who was at that point an orphan. They'd adopt them, bring them into their family. But what ended up, what resulted there was boys were forced to be gladiators or servants or slaves. So they were used. They were networked. They became property. And if it was a young lady, that young lady became property, became a servant or a slave of the household, and many times and in many cases became a prostitute. So in this case, we're talking about little people being adopted, not because they're being grafted in and becoming heirs of something, but because they're going to be used. They're going to become the property of an owner. And those are two forms of unjust slavery. You know, a slave that becomes a slave simply for losing a battle, or a person who becomes a slave simply because their parents discarded them, somebody else picked them up, and didn't even make their life better. Now, I want to insert an idea here with regards to this thing called adoption that we're talking about. This is where Christianity kind of emerged as this new world order, this new perspective, this new view on life. And Christianity has always valued things that society devalues. So when you hear a theme like slavery, know that Christians were the original abolitionists. They were the people that fought tooth and nail to end things like slavery. And so when it came to little children being left on the streets, Christians were the people that came to their aid and said, God values people so much
that we have to value these little people. And we're not just going to bring them into our home and feed them and clothe them. We're going to consider them a part of us, a part of what God is doing in our family, a part of what God is going to have us do in the world. And so Christianity, as a result of some of these atrocities, really emerges as the only worldview that ultimately values people, that ultimately honors the fact that people are made in the likeness and image of God. So we've looked at American slavery, we looked at Roman slavery, and I think what we can deduce is this is complicated. It's not clean cut. In some cases, it makes sense to be a slave, like say, you know, economic collapse and you go work for somebody. In some cases, it is absolutely atrocious and sinful and should be avoided at all costs. It should be actively warred against. But it's complicated. And so when Paul is addressing the idea of slaves and masters, he knows that it's complicated. And we can't assume that because he's not outwardly saying, hey, stop slavery altogether, that Paul is somehow condoning slavery, because he's not. And in fact, if you look at a letter that he wrote to Philemon, he actually is, he's giving a charge. He's saying, please, and he's talking about a very specific individual. He's saying, stop treating that person as a slave. That person is an heir. And Paul, in other areas of his writings, he says things like, there's neither slave nor free. Like Paul, what he's saying in effect is Jesus levels the playing field, but Paul is a realist. He's in prison when he's writing this letter. And he also realizes that you as individuals, that me as an individual, there's a world we have to navigate. And it's not a world of ideals. It's a world that has some real challenges. And in this day and age, one of those challenges was this relationship between slaves and masters. And so instead of saying, stop being a slave and stop being a master, Paul is saying, bring the gospel to bear in the context of this relationship. And so if we fast forward some 2,000 years, because that's where we happen to be on a timeline, I don't know about you, and regardless of how you feel about your boss, I don't think that your boss refers to you as a slave. I mean, can I get like a head nod? It's like, yeah, my boss doesn't refer to me as a slave. So my boss doesn't refer to me as a slave. I'm assuming yours doesn't refer to you as a slave. And I'm assuming that if you're a boss, people aren't coming up to you on a daily saying, hey, master, what should we do today? Like, it's not playing out like that. So because that's the case, because the language has changed, because the dynamics have changed, we're going to apply a couple of different terms to this conversation. And those terms are employee, like meaning you work. There's a contractual agreement. There are things that you're supposed to produce and deliver. Right, and in return for that, you work for an employer, someone who has authority to say, hey, this is how you're going to spend your Tuesday afternoon. This is what we've employed you to do. And their responsibility is to give you some sense of direction, but it's also to compensate you for the goods and services that you render. So instead of using the terminology of slaves and masters, we're gonna transition and we'll start using the terminology of employee and employer, or worker, subordinate, and supervisor. We good? We good with that? All right. Now, before we say anything else, I'd like to present you with two paradigms when it comes to work. And maybe there are multiple paradigms outside of this, but I think these are two of the main paradigms that we face as people who have jobs, some of us. And for those of us who don't have jobs, hopefully you got some fire in you to get one. And if not, talk to your mom and dad, because they're going to put some fire in you to get one. At any rate, these are the two paradigms. And I think on one end of the spectrum, you have overemphasis. These are people that worship their work. Like, their job is the most important thing that they can come up with when they think about priorities. Like, that's where they invest their time. That's where they invest their effort. And in effect, that's where they find their identity. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people that are, they underemphasize work. And basically what they're saying is, look, I don't know about you, but this is just a source of income for me. This is where I draw a paycheck. This is how I get what I need to do what I want to do on the weekends. Like, this is the means by which I experience leisure. And so their goal is not to build an identity around work. Their goal is to have fun, like have a nice life. So they're finding their identity in leisure, whereas the other person is finding their identity in work. And I think those are two basic paradigms. So on one end, you have somebody that says, I exist As a result of this work, my identity is built around this work. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have people that are basically saying, my job is the worst job in the world. It's menial. It's unimportant. It's meaningless. It has no purpose other than to provide a source of income for me. And what happens then is, instead of engaging, you disengage. Instead of pressing in, you retreat. Instead of giving it full force and all you've got, you go halfway. You show up late, you leave early, you disengage, and in some cases, you disengage entirely because you despise what you do. So if these are the two paradigms, overemphasis and underemphasis, I would like to present you with what I believe is how we're supposed to understand work. And I don't care what you do or what you don't do. I don't care if you're doing something that you love or something that you hate. If you are working, I want you to consider thinking about work like this. Work, it's not a curse, it's a calling. So work is a calling. It's not a curse, and it doesn't matter what you do. Whether you're a police officer, a firefighter, a teacher, an executive, a CEO, a guy who pushes a broom or a mop, work is a calling. And the reason why I'm arguing that it's a calling, I'll lay it out pretty clearly for you. But the reason why I'm saying that is, it's like that's what you're doing today. That's what you're doing, right? If God is in control of time and space and human history, he's allowed you to do that. For whatever reason, and we could talk ad nauseum about reasons why God allows people to do certain things, but he has you where he has you for a reason that you may or may not understand. So work, my friends, let's think of it as a calling and not a curse. And if we go all the way back to the beginning, we see God working. We see him working to make everything. We see him working to take care of everything. And then we get to Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, and we see God empowering the man that he made, that's Adam, to work. And this is pre-fall. No curse. There's no curse that's occurred up to this point in time. Nothing is wrong with the way things are. The world in which Adam and Eve live is described as perfect. Things are in perfect harmony, perfect relationship with the God who made them. And God says to Adam, or here's what we read in Genesis 2:15: the Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and watch over it. So I present you with the idea that work is a part of our DNA. It's a part of our makeup. It's a part of how we were made, because we see work in the context of paradise before things fell apart. And I know when I say things like work's in our DNA, maybe you're thinking, well, I know people and they must have some sort of like weird gene mutation because they're doing the opposite of work. There's no way. That must be like the recessive gene in them because like they don't work. Now, mind you, there are a variety of reasons why people don't work. But ultimately, if you're not working, if you're designed to do something and you're not doing it, you will never be fulfilled. You'll never feel a sense of purpose and fulfillment. So just keep that in mind. And again, our MO when we interact with people is we don't beat people up. We meet people with the grace that God met us with. All right, so let's go ahead and move on. And because I think another thought that we have when it comes to work is some of us are thinking, well, you know what? I have this job and I am convinced that it is a direct result of sin. Like it has to be. The whole way that it's designed, the way that people interact with each other, the way that the boss gives out orders, like it is clearly a result of sin. Now, mind you, maybe it is, because I think some jobs are sinful, and I'm not even going to lay out which ones I believe are sinful because I don't want you to get mad at me, but some jobs are sinful, but I think anytime you see that lazy coworker or colleague, you experience the overbearing boss or a work system that just feels broken, what you're experiencing is how the dynamics of work have changed as a direct result of sin. Work itself is not a curse, but work has been cursed, if that makes sense. Work, like everything else, has been maimed and marred as a direct result of sin. And so we experience the tainted dynamics of work in our jobs. And so what that means is we've got to calibrate ourselves to something, to a perspective about work that actually is true, and it's aligned with how God would have us understand work. And I think it's simply this, that it's not a curse, It's a calling. And there's more to the story, but I think if we start there, that's something to work with. And another way that we should understand work is this. God started, he created everything, but then he starts delegating work to people. And I don't know about you, but like I wake up in the morning and I grab coffee beans and I throw them in a grinder and I make coffee and I do that. And there's this whole morning routine going on. Put cereal on the table, pour some milk in it for the kids. And all I can say about that is I have never farmed coffee in my life. I've never milked a cow. I've never grown a whole lot of anything. And so God delegated farming to someone so that we could have that experience over breakfast, lunch, dinner. Our way of life is built upon this idea that somebody else is taking care of it in the background so that on the foreground we can benefit. So God is taking care of us through the menial efforts of other people. And some of us are involved in those menial efforts. And so what I'm arguing today is there's no such thing as a menial effort because God is using what we describe as menial efforts as a means of taking care of what he's made, the people he's made, the creation he's made. All right? So I've never milked a cow, but I've had a lot of cream in my coffee. I'll put it that way. So work, it's part of our DNA. And as a church, what we're trying to aim ourselves at is preparing people to think and act like missionaries, to go back into your sphere of influence, meet people where they are, meet them with grace, introduce them to the person and work of Jesus so that their lives can be completely transformed, so that they can actually become the people that God made them to be. And so I say this to you, church, Jesus, he has his eyes on your workplace and on your role inside the context of that workplace, and he cares deeply about how you spend your time on the clock. And so, I want to convince you of something with the duration of my time, and that something is simply this, that when it comes to supervisors, and when it comes to employees, the reason why we can have a healthy relationship with the people in our workplace, and we don't have to get all judgmental and angry with the folks that we're working with, and the folks that we're working for, is ultimately, Jesus is our true and better boss. He's our true and better master. Ultimately, if you are a follower of Jesus, you're not working for who you say you work for. You have a direct supervisor. I'm not telling you to go back to work and be like, hey, you know, FYI, I don't work for you anymore. I've been free and clear to that. Like, please do not do that. And if you do that, tell them that you attended some other church this week, because I'm not into that. So I'm not saying go and break the chain of command, because there are clear chains of command. What I am saying is he wants to give you the resources to look through your supervisor, to look through your circumstances, to look through your misgiven ideas about work, and look him in the face and say, Jesus, like, I know you care about me more than I care about myself. I know that you're going to supervise me better than anyone would ever supervise me, and I am going to work with all of my might because you are my true and better boss. And here's what Paul says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 22. He says, slaves, obey your human masters in everything. Whatever you do, do it enthusiastically as something done for the Lord and not for men, knowing that you will receive the reward of an inheritance from the Lord Christ. All right, so Paul is talking about employees and employers, and that's how we need to understand this. And he's trying to reorient us. He's trying to help us apply the gospel in the context of this relationship. And so he's very specific, and this is hard. This is a tough call right here. He says, do whatever your human master says. Do whatever your supervisor says, right? This isn't a green light to cook the books or to manipulate clients or to do things that are off kilter with what God would have you do. This isn't a green light to embark on this journey of like jaded morals and not doing the right thing. But what this is a green light. It's Paul telling you, when your boss speaks, like, just do what they say. Respond. Respond as an employee. Take their direction. Heed their advice. Do what they're asking you to do. But don't be unethical about it. He's saying, regardless of the kind of relationship you have with your boss, regardless of whether or not your boss meets your criteria of success or productivity or niceness or whatever it is, regardless of whether your boss is even on the rating scale, obey your supervisor. Do what they say. And don't just do it when they're watching. Paul is saying, people who follow Jesus, they're working from a resource pool that's deep, it's embedded inside of them, and it gives them an enthusiasm and a zeal that's unmatched anywhere in the universe. Like, do this enthusiastically. Put the gospel on display through your work, through the way that you engage with your colleagues, through the way that you do whatever it is you do. If you mop floors, make it so people can eat off of them. If you put handcuffs on people, for goodness sake. I don't even know what that means. But do it with all your might. Don't hold anything back. Play like it's the last game. Like it's the last swing you're going to take. It's the last opportunity you're going to have. Because, it very well may be. But Paul is saying this because he's saying, look, your supervisor is not even going to ever ask you to do this. He's never going to ask you to go as far as Jesus is asking you to go. And he's never going to deliver what Jesus ultimately delivers when he gets to that point of talking about an inheritance. Like, this is not a 401k. This isn't an annuity that you're going to collect at the end of a number of years of service. Like, this is something that's going to blow you out the water. It's going to blow your mind. Like, Jesus is saying, you don't just have access to the inheritance, you're a part of it. You have been grafted in, you've been welcomed home. And that gets, like, back to that whole social status thing as a slave. Jesus is saying, you're not a slave in my house. You're a part of what my house is. Like, you're a part of the fabric of my house. So the benefits that I reap are benefits that you reap. That's a big deal. That's something you're never going to get from an employer. You're never going to get from a boss. The best you're going to get is a couple decades, maybe 3 decades in, you'll get a cool plaque and a luncheon. Right? Good job. I feel so validated. I love ham and cheese. And I'm embarrassed to put the plaque up. So, ultimately, I think what Paul is doing for us is he's saying, look, I want you to be free in the workplace. I don't want you to click your seatbelt and be driving towards your job thinking, I hate this job. And if only my boss would, like, make these 14 different adjustments, this would be a more healthy work environment. Paul does not want you to be miserable at work. He wants you to be liberated. He wants you to stop orienting your work behavior towards your opinion of your boss or your compensation package or the tiff you had with the guy in the lunchroom or whatever it may be. Or the next big thing that's coming down the executive pipeline. Paul does not want you to be motivated by that. He wants you to be motivated by the fact that Jesus is your true and better boss, that Jesus always has your best interest at heart, and that Jesus is giving you the freedom to succeed and fail in the workplace. Because Jesus has fully accepted you. Now, I know this is way easier said than done because, I'm a person, you're a person, right? We can talk this all day long, but when the rubber meets the road, like, your boss is still that guy. You know, you have a hard time smiling at him or whatever the case may be. So the other point of liberation is this. Like, you don't have to critique him anymore. Or her, if it's a her. Like, that's not it. Like, Paul is saying, guess what? God has this on lock. You don't have to critique your boss. You don't have to come up with 14 bullet points as to how they're going to better run this company or this organization. You're being given a card of access, of freedom, to operate like you've never operated before, unimpeded, unhindered by opinion or misperception when it comes to the workplace. Like, you're being given a resource that's going to allow you to give it your all, to work with all your might and do whatever it is that you're doing. Paul ultimately is saying, apply the gospel, the richest resource in the universe. Apply it in the workplace. And here's what happens when we don't do that. Again, we'll become people who are so emphasized on success or definitions of success that we want to have the biggest and the brightest when it comes to a resume. We work to prove ourselves. We work to find a sense of security and a sense of identity. Now, the crazy part is this. We get old all the while, right? And I am sorry to break it to you, but you are going to be wrinkly. Your face is going to sag. Sorry if your face is already sagging. And you're going to be looking in the mirror going, what happened to me? I can't even do what I used to be able to do. I can't even move. The reality is you can't work that hard. You're never going to be, you can't make it. That's the beauty of the gospel. The gospel says, hey, let's get honest. You're not going to do it anyway. Jesus did it. Come on board. Ultimately, your drive, your continued drive is going to produce the biggest sense of letdown and insecurity you've ever experienced. If your work life is centered on that. It's centered on your definition of success and your pursuit of identity through your work. And if you have this view of work where you're just I don't want to do that anymore. I don't even know why I'm doing this in the first place. You have a perception about work that's centered on something else. It's not centered on finding fulfillment in whatever you do. It's centered on, if I could only land that job, if I could only get that promotion, if they could only give me a shot. The reality is God has you doing what you're doing for a very specific reason. And it doesn't matter if you understand what that is, but you're doing what you're doing because God has you there. And so what Paul, in essence, is saying, stop centering your life on an overemphasis of work or a de-emphasis of work and start centering your life on the finished work of Jesus so that you can stop working for the wrong boss, so that you can stop working from the wrong motivation, and so that you can start worshiping Jesus through your work, so that you can start working from your identity in Jesus and find meaning in absolutely everything that you do. I think that's what Paul's talking about when he's addressing employees. Now, Paul goes on, and in verse 1, he shifts gears a bit, and he starts aiming at employers, supervisors. These are people who have subordinates, people who are in a position of authority. And he says, masters, supply your slaves with what is right and fair, since you know that you too have a master in heaven. I mean, he's blowing it out at the door. He's like, so you think you're in charge? Guess what? You're not in charge. I mean, that's freeing, right? Should be freeing if you're in a supervisory role. You're not really in charge. Someone else is in charge. And so what that effectively means is when you fail as a supervisor, you don't fail as a supervisor. Because Jesus has already succeeded. I mean, that's got to be freeing. No longer are you measured by human metrics of success. You're measured by Jesus' finished work. But I think there's a little bit more to it than that. And I think if you're in a position of authority, know this, that it's not so that you can have authority. That's not the goal of leadership or authority. It's not so that you can have authority or expand your power zone or whatever you want to call it. It's so that you can actively empower other people to follow Jesus. And so your leadership style should be marked by specific behaviors. And Paul gives us two. And he says, do what is right and do what is fair. He's talking about justice and righteousness. He's talking about being willing to take one for the team, to take one off the chin, to defend your employees, to take the heat when it gets hot in the kitchen, to take the first risk, to eat last, to disadvantage yourself to the advantage of the people who work for you. You're seeking to serve instead of wanting to be served. You're no longer networking your employees or your little team. You're trying to do something for them, to empower them, to become the people that God made them to be. It's no longer about using people. It's about empowering people at that point in time. And so your efforts, if you're in a leadership role, they should be oriented towards the people that you're leading, the people that you're supervising. You want to have their best interests in mind. And the reason is Jesus always has our best interests in mind. He always meets us with grace. His goal is to move us forward in faith. And And I think an interesting picture of this idea of righteousness and justice, I think we find this in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 27 and 28. And what we read there is, when it's in your power, don't withhold good from the one it belongs to. Don't say to your neighbor, go away, come back later, I'll give it tomorrow, when it is there with you. If you are in a leadership role, like, leverage your power, leverage your authority to benefit others. Don't withhold things from people. Don't lord over people. Don't abuse your coworkers. Do things with their best interests in mind. Because here's the thing. If you're a leader and you abuse your authority, congratulations. You've been added to the long list of leaders throughout human history who have effectively, like, ruined it. They've abused their authority. And in fact, if you look at the common thread throughout human history, is that people who have been in positions of superiority have always abused people who are in lesser positions, socially, economically, racially. Like, superiors always abuse the subordinates, and if we're looking at human history very generically. And so I want to show you something. I want to show you how the gospel subverts that. Because the one with absolute authority, the most superior human being that the world has ever known, the God-man Jesus, like, he doesn't use his authority to oppress people or suppress people or to disadvantage people. He leverages his identity as the God of the universe to make a way for us when we weren't even looking for a way. That's why Jesus is our true and better boss. That's why he's our true and better master. And if you're a leader or you're a supervisor or what have you, the reality is, like, we failed. We missed the mark. We don't always lead with other people in mind. And if you're an employee, you haven't always done what your boss told you to do. I mean, some of you probably stole copy paper this week, but I'm not talking about that. The reality is, like, or maybe you stole 14 hours because you were on Facebook a lot. At any rate, we've missed the mark. That's the beauty of the gospel. It's honest with us. It's God getting honest with us, and he's saying, hey, you have fallen short, but it's going to be okay. The reality is, we need someone that can take care of us in a way that we've never been taken care of. And I think that's what makes Jesus the only response to all of this. He's the only one capable of allowing us to work the way that we're supposed to and to interact in the workplace the way that we're supposed to. And when we see Jesus interacting with people in human history, or he's born in a manger, very inconspicuous. I mean, like, literally, he's born next to an area where animals are, like, using the bathroom. This is not a glorious entering. This is not a glorious arrival by any stretch of the terms. Jesus is becoming lesser so that we can become more. I mean, do you see how that's happening? Jesus is experiencing humiliation so that we can experience this thing called glorification. That's what Jesus is doing. And so as he's navigating human history and he's interacting with people, he's giving value to people who have never been valued. The woman at the well. He gives her value. He reaches through cultural, racial, socioeconomic barriers, and he says, I love you, I care about you, I want what's best for you. You look at Zacchaeus, he's a tax collector. He's in a tree. He's calling attention to himself when he probably shouldn't have been, because I don't know about you guys, but if the IRS is climbing a tree in my yard, I'm not going to be like, hey, you hungry? Please don't use that against me. What I'm saying is, Jesus looks at Zacchaeus and he says, my working knowledge of you, guess what? I know everything about you. And because I know everything about you, I'm never going to become disillusioned with you. It's never going to get to a point with Jesus where he's like, you know what? I really wish you would have done a better job. Jesus already fully understands who you are. He already knows exactly what you need. When Jesus welcomes children to sit on his lap, to hang out with them, he's doing something that was unprecedented. The people around him are kind of cowering in the corner, like, what is he doing? He's wasting time. Jesus has always valued the oppressed. people who are considered slaves, the subordinates by way of society's standards, Jesus has always identified with us. And that's what he's doing when he comes. And here's what this means. We read in Galatians where Paul says, God has sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you're no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Like this is a big deal, because Jesus isn't just identifying with the oppressed. Jesus is becoming oppressed so that we no longer have to be. Jesus is bearing the entire weight of oppression so that we don't have to. Because ultimately, Jesus knows that we can't. We can't solve our own problem. And I'll just give it to you like this. Your problem's not your boss. It's not your working conditions. It's not your compensation package. The problem is deep inside of us. The problem is the fact that everything's been ravaged by sin. And that if Jesus doesn't come, our lives will be marked by us reaching higher and higher and higher and never hitting the mark. Never arriving at a sense of fulfillment. Never arriving at a sense of purpose, because we can't get there in and of ourselves. And so here's what we see when we take a peek at what Jesus has done. We see that Jesus is the ultimate master. And he saw every last one of us chained to the auction block of slavery to sin. He saw us oppressed. He saw how we were devalued and discarded and ridiculed and made to feel like we're worthless. And he didn't just look at us. He entered the conversation. He negotiated on our behalf. He said, I want to buy them. I want to purchase them. And he didn't even ask what the going rate was, because he had something more to give. And that something more to give was himself. Jesus himself became a slave. He chained himself to the auction block of slavery to sin. And he said, not them, but me. Take me. Jesus bore the brunt of absolutely everything we've ever done. Everything we're ever going to do that's contrary to what God would have us do, the lives that God would have us live. Jesus bought us at the auction block. He ransomed us. He took his life and he gave it for ours. And so when I say that Jesus is our true and better boss, our true and better master, it's because Jesus knows absolutely everything about us. And he's never going to reach the point of disillusionment with us. He's never going to grow tired of helping us or meeting us where we are or applying grace to the areas of our lives that are still totally dysfunctional. He's never going to get to the point where he says, I'm done. I can't do anything more for you. Jesus has done everything for us. He's written us into his family estate. He's welcomed us home. He's made us a part of who he is and what he's doing. Jesus is our true and better boss because he leveraged his authority. He bore the weight of oppression so that we don't have to be oppressed. Instead of oppressing us, which he had full right to do so, because we sinned against him. Instead of oppressing us, he bore the weight of our oppression so that slaves like you and me could be free. That's all I got for you this morning.